Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hey, Shireen.
This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Anna. Wow, what an episode we have for y'all today. It is a delight. You're going to fall in love with our guest because both of us are in love with her. It's Jennifer Jaje.
Yes, we talk about her upbringing in San Francisco. We talk about her experience being a Palestinian American woman in this country, moving to Palestine, living there, creating shows based on her experience, and her relationship with her parents. It's a very chill Californian episode.
Don't go anywhere.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pets? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hello, Shireen.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good, Anna. Thank you for asking me.
You're welcome, Shireen.
You're in a new place today. You just said that you jumped out of the ocean and ran to record this. You're living the life.
I know. I'm still in my bathing suit. I'm covered in sand and seaweed. I ran from the beach here like, gotta go! Gotta go get a recording!
Gotta record a podcast! I would love like random people on the beach to like hear you say that. Just like, I gotta go record a podcast!
I'm sure they did. I was like yelling. I'm here with Arden Marine and Brian Safi. Former guest, Brian Safi.
Yes.
And I was just like, peace out. I got to go record my podcast. And they were like, bye. And yeah, that's I was doing beautiful. Some body surfing, which is, you know what? I was like the Atlantic Ocean. I'm about to be freezing. Honestly, nicer than the Pacific Ocean.
I believe you.
Like I would sooner go in this water than I would in LA go in the water. Cause I'm like, it's cold. Apparently there's also sewage in it. I don't know.
I imagine it less dirty. Is that an accurate assumption? Maybe not.
It's very seaweedy. I have so much seaweed all over me. There's these bluffs with like diving boards built into them. So I jumped off those after waiting with some like 10-year-olds. And then there's like hot, young, like teenage lifeguards like watching. And you're like, no big deal. I'm just jumping with my 10-year-olds. You feel like an old divorcee creeping on young...
Yeah.
Like 17-year-old boys. God.
That's...
Maybe they're not. They might be older. I don't know. Little hotties.
Yeah.
God, I am a creep. I'm just like.
Little hotties. You heard it here
hotties.
First. You heard it here first.
18 or older. Okay. Whoa.
Yeah.
Relax.
Yeah. But that's so fun. I'm excited funny. That you're not in LA. I really need to get out of here.
I'm in Little Compton, Rhode Island. It's a town of 3,000 people. Everyone waves at you.
The infamous hometown of Arden Marine.
Yes. I went to Boston first. Everyone really has those accents. It's not a joke.
It's not just a put-on accent.
I was like, wow, it's not
Mark
just
Wahlberg,
TV, huh?
Mark Wahlberg isn't putting on an accent this whole time.
No, I got off the train. Everyone's like, yeah. And I was like, oh my God. It's real.
That's very funny. Let's bring in our guest. We've known her for a while. I just can't believe she hasn't been on yet. I really thought she had been on, but my brain is complete goo. She's a Palestinian-American comedian. I think we met her when we performed together, all three of us, on the Arab Spring Break show, like in 2019. That was really fun. And her name is Jennifer Jaje. Welcome.
Hi. Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
finally
being here. I know I feel embarrassed that you haven't been on.
I'm like gonna use like Arab shaming right now and be like, no, it's fine, you didn't invite me,
like the passive aggressiveness,
like, exactly.
Yeah, kiss on each cheek. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in so long.
Yeah, it's weird.
Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Yes,
thanks for having me. So, damn it, why am I not at the beach? What's going on?
I know.
Why are we in LA, Shireen? What are we doing wrong?
Everything. We're doing everything wrong.
Everything wrong.
I need to get out of here ASAP. I am trying to go to Oregon in August, so hopefully that works out. But I just need to be in a forest, man. I'm less of a beach person. I'm more of a forest person. So that's where I need to go. I want to go in a lake, a forest lake.
Every forest we've driven by here, Arden goes, that's haunted. Oh. Like, okay, New England. We get it. You're all witches. Okay.
Your haunted tour guide. I like it.
Everything. She's like, three witches live there. Those woods are haunted. That house is haunted. And I'm like, how? She's like, we don't ask. And you're like, what? You know, just like puritanical New England. You're like, okay. Funny.
That's crazy. Yeah. Didn't you always have, like, as a kid, we always had that house that we were like, that's a haunted house. Like, crazy people live there. Or we always had the house in our neighborhood that mm-hmm. we pointed that out. And then we'd, like, see someone in the window and all scream and mm-hmm. run.
Yeah. Usually it was just dark on Halloween, you know? Like, mm-hmm. it's just one of those.
I will say, because this house is in the middle, like, so it's like one of those like country cliff towns. So like it's like surrounded by water and like beaches, but everything on the cliffs is completely like country spread out, like big land. And so houses are on these like, you know, giant lots. And so like all the windows, you know, the blinds are up at night. And a part of me is always like, it's so creepy that there's nothing else around you that if anyone walked by the window, I would have a full-on heart attack because it would make no sense because we're in the middle of nowhere. I would die if I saw someone outside that I didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
I agree.
There's only been one murder in this town. It happened 20 years ago, and the story that I was told is the most terrifying thing I've ever heard, and I'm like, you shouldn't have ever told me that.
You gotta say it now.
It was this woman, the guy doing construction on her house basically like kidnapped her in her own house, raped her, and then like electrocuted her in her bathtub to death.
What?
Sorry, I should have said like warned. Oh, I told you it is. So, you were like, tell the story. I'm like, okay.
Sorry, I didn't realize how. Yeah, that's horrifying. Genuinely. Anyway, we have a great guest on today.
And so you tell me that, and then I'm in a house in the middle of nowhere. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Yay. Let's segue.
Thank you, Jennifer, so much for being here. We talked a little about haunted houses. Where did you grow up, and why did you think the house next to you was haunted? I'm just kidding. Guys, where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Francisco.
Okay. I can see some haunted looking places up there.
Oh, yeah. Like, we had all of these. Like, I grew up in the 80s. And so we were just like random wild kids on the street whose parents were like, get out of the house and don't come back till it's dark. And so we would just run the streets with like this gang of crazy kids and decided houses were haunted. And there was this old deserted drive-in that we would go to and hang out. Mm-hmm. And like always we'd be hanging out there and someone would always be like, wait, did you hear that? Did you see that? And it's the middle of the day. It's like a sunny afternoon. And we're like, and they were like, oh my God, I saw someone. And then everybody was like, no, oh my God. And it was like just kids screaming and running. And it's like, we would just freak each other out all the time. And we thought everything was haunted. So
what was it like growing up in San Francisco?
I mean, it was awesome. This was before like helicopter moms and like after school stuff, you know, like nobody had soccer and this and that and piano. Like parents were just totally like, yeah, we're hanging out and like smoking a cigarette and like drinking coffee with our friends, get out of our faces. Like they didn't care if you had like after school activities or things. There was no, like your mom was not going to drive you anywhere. She was like, just go be a kid. Like, and so it was awesome growing up at that time because I felt like I was like the last generation that got to be like just a super free kid, like with your own imagination and your own
less
crew.
Pressure. No pressure.
Like, oh, you don't want to do piano? Cool. We don't care. Like, I was like, I hate piano. It sucks. They were like, man, I tried it. Yeah. You know, like there was no pressure. And it was like you had the sense of freedom and control over your existence, which I feel like kids now are so micromanaged. Like, I talk to my nieces and nephews, and they're just like, oh yeah, I'm here to hear from this time, and I'm here to hear, and I'm here. And like, there's no unstructured time. It's just weird. I'm glad I don't have kids.
Yeah.
But it sounds like your parents are pretty, what's the word? Like, not very strict. Usually Middle Eastern parents are pretty strict and like a little bit too far in the other direction. I think I had that problem. Like, I wasn't allowed to really do anything. What was it like having Palestinian parents in San Francisco? Did you realize it was like atypical, or was it just like normal?
Well, I definitely did have the cooler Palestinian parents because I had like two lives. I had my American life and my Palestinian life.
Always. Yeah.
So my parents were like the coolest Palestinian parents, but like still pretty strict for American parents.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I also was 6 of 7 kids. So by the time, like, they had been worn down by, like...
Everything makes sense now.
They were so worn down. They were just like, just don't do anything embarrassing to us. And
don't die and don't embarrass us.
Like, and make sure you watch your sister. Like, yeah. I had a younger sister. They were like, just watch her. Make sure she doesn't die. Make sure you don't die. Mm-hmm. Don't do anything embarrassing. And we're cool. Just, like, I think also my mom at that point was, like, so checked out after, like, being an immigrant mom with so many kids who, like, didn't really want to be in America and claimed she wanted to have all these kids, but I don't believe it. And then she just wanted to, like, smoke cigarettes and have coffee with her friends and be like, see you later. Go do something. Go be a kid. Get the, you know, get out of my face.
Right.
I want to, like, talk to my friends about how we all hate our husbands and, like, hate America. Like, that was...
Yeah, so how did your parents end up in SF?
So my parents left Palestine individually. They're both from the same hometown of Ramallah. Ramallah is basically a town of like 7 main families, they say, who knows? And then like offshoots of those 7 families is everybody. So you're related to everybody technically. Mm. So they separately, their families like left in the 50s because things were, there was just like a threat of ongoing violence. And they were like, we don't know if Ramallah is going to be like overtaken. We don't know if we're going to be attacked. Like there was just this sense of looming danger. And so my grandfather came to America when he was 13 to start working to send money back to his family.
13?
When he was 13. I know, this is so crazy. When I meet guys who are 40 and are like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I'm like, dude, seriously, my grandfather was like supporting an entire family at 13. I can't with you.
Did he travel here alone and like land somewhere alone?
Yeah, so basically his dad died when he was 13 and his mom was like, all right, you're the man of the family. Step up. Like, you got to go make some money. And he took a boat.
Wow.
As you
do. Came to America. Like, figured it out, started selling, like, peddling items on the street, like, ended up making enough money to keep sending money back, but also to keep going back and forth.
Right.
Goes back to Palestine, gets married to some older woman. I think she was, like, 4 years older. Like, and
that's
so
still,
then he
that's
has,
still a big deal in Arab culture, though.
Oh, like, yeah. Oh, so then he has a second family to support. Ends up like making enough money to buy a house, bring all his family over, put them all through college, like seriously hustled. And so in the 50s, he had kids, he was married, and he basically was like, look, I have a house in Florida. Like, let's go. Like, we're getting out of here. This is too scary. We'll come back. My mom was like, a kid, I think she was like 12 or 13 at the time, maybe a little older. And she was like, all right, I'm just going to pack a bag. Like, they were like, we're going to go on this fun voyage. We're going to America. And then when they got there, they were like, oh, psych, we're probably not going back because they're not going to let us back in.
Right, right.
And so she was devastated that she was like, I can't believe you tricked me into thinking we were going on this fun trip. And now like my entire life got ripped away. Mm. And so they ended up in Florida, and then eventually, like, all of the Palestinians from Ramallah kind of settled in a few different places around the U.S., and I think some even in, like, Chile and Argentina. And so, my mom said she has family in Chile and Argentina, but my dad's family all pretty much settled in the Bay Area, and so when they got married, they went out there, and that... Oh, arranged marriage, dude. Seriously, arranged marriage. They were like, you're the same age and you're from the same town. Cool. Let's make Palestinian babies. And my mom was like, no, I don't want to do this. And my dad's like, she's hot. Cool. And he definitely got the better end of the deal. I mean, my mom was a babe. My dad was like a sweet, sweet, dorky man. And my mom was like a total babe. So she was like, are men never the catch? Is this what you're saying, Shireen?
It's even like a meme going around. Like, you always see like a really hot babe with like an average looking guy. You know what I mean? I think it's like that across cultures, but I'm going to shut up before I dig a hole deeper.
No, I mean, I think so. I'm not trying to be like these fucking gross ass Middle Eastern men. You know, that's not the case. But it is more like sometimes you kind of see like a man who's like made some money. He's not exactly, you know, the most attractive guy. And then he's with like a hot Middle Eastern wife. Yes. And you're like, okay.
Like the most beautiful friend of my mom's. Like she's model gorgeous. She married an older psychiatrist and there is no world where if he wasn't a psychiatrist, he would end up with her. Like, there's just no world, you know? It just something like that just reminds me of, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's pretty common. Like, especially because Arab women also take such good care. Like,
yes.
There's so much value in their appearance. Not like it's not in other cultures, but like,
self-care is taken pretty seriously.
Self-care is taken really seriously. And honestly, like, my mom thought she was Liz Taylor and she like literally every wedding or like convention or party was like her runway. Like she was just like, I am going to have like, my mom to this day has like 2-inch long nails and she's like an elderly person. People are like, lady, this is a lot. Like you can't.
My mom is way too hot. Like, I know that about my mom. Like she's like, I see younger pictures of her. Like she was always a smoke show.
Smoke show.
Yeah, smoke show. She looks great. But even now, like when we take group family photos, I have 2 sisters. She's just the hottest one out of all of us. And we all accept it. It's fine.
Yeah, I just think we don't put that kind of effort. I mean, I don't. My mom's always like, you know, you could get your hair done. And I'm like, you know, I mean, I have a lot of other concerns right now.
Yeah. I want to know how you got into comedy and stuff and what your family thought of that. But first, let's take a commercial break and we'll be right back. And we're back. When did you realize growing up that you liked comedy?
Well, it's funny because when I was about 10, I decided that I was going to direct like all the neighborhood productions that didn't exist because I was making them. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, I'm the director and we're doing shows in Noelle Stewart's backyard, my next door neighbor, because she had a big backyard. And I was actually heartless. Like I would hire people, fire people, direct them, write their shows for them. I was like, okay, you do a cartwheel and then you're going to do a little like speech and then you're going to do we're going to improvise something. And then people would be like, I don't want to do that. And I'm like, fine, you're fired. I'll replace you. Like I was like,
ruthless.
And Noelle was like, it's my backyard. We're performing in. I was like, I don't care. You're fired. We're still having rehearsals.
Michael Bay who?
Yeah,
seriously. I have a mean streak and I have like kind of a harsh, I don't know where it comes from. I've always been this way as a kid. I'm like, you're dead to me. Move on. I'm moving on. So that's kind of how it started where I would like write and perform and set up performances and direct and be like the boss of my neighborhood, the scary, scary boss of my neighborhood. And, and then I just kind of went from there. And my mom kind of nurtured it and was into it because she was like, I always wanted to be a performer.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
But my dad was like, yeah, this is a pastime and don't ever think this is a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I ask what your dad does for work or what he did if he's not working anymore?
He was a pharmacist.
Okay. So he was like about the work.
Oh, yeah. He like had 7 kids to feed. He was like, you need to be a scientist. You're a smart girl. You're really good at math and science. Like, why are you trying to waste your life?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Naturally.
Yeah. The prototypical Arab, you know.
There are a lot of Arab pharmacists. Track. There are so many Arab pharmacists. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about, but it was awesome as a kid because I would just call my dad and be like, Daddy, I don't feel good. Can you make me some medicine? And he was like, what flavor do you want? And I was
that's
like,
hilarious. Make me some medicine.
I know. This is why I was heavily medicated as a child, dude. Seriously. Like, he would just be like, I brought you home some mint flavored medicine. And I was like, cool. Can I take it? And my mom was like, stop giving her medicine.
Like, that's nice, though.
Yeah.
My dad also let me drink beer when I was like 10 years old. So,
you know. Okay. What a a very cool Palestinian family in my book, but yeah.
I mean, my dad would always be like, you got to try it. Try it once. Just take a sip. It's fine. Just try it.
Alcohol was outlawed in my house. We never had alcohol in the house. It was against the rules. If my parents even found out I tried alcohol now, I think they'd be like, we're judging you.
Your parents aren't dumb. They know.
No, they're not dumb. I just don't think they want to. I think, cool, my sister got married last month to a white person. And so all of his family drinks. And at the wedding, it was like there was alcohol there. I was drinking like a whiskey sour or something. And I think my dad saw me and he just like, you could tell the look on his face. He's like, I don't want to see this. I'd rather just like pretend she never has alcohol, never is with anybody. So I think it's just ignorance is bliss for a lot of Arab parents, you know?
I agree. Yeah. I mean, my parents were like, Like I said, I had the cool Arab parents. Like, for some reason, my parents, by the time I came along, were like, we don't care. You want some, like, yeah, I would be at weddings and I would always want to hang out with all the men because I was like, the women are boring. I want to hang out with the men. And so I would go outside with my dad and like hang out with all the guys, like smoking cigars and drinking scotch. And I'd be like, Dad, can I have some? And he'd be like, just a little sip. And I'm like, I'm 12, dude. Like, cool. A little sip of scotch to a 12-year-old.
Yeah. My dad did give me a cigar at the wedding because like it was like a whole thing. He like brought out cigars for all the men, and I was like, "Can I get one of those?" And he was like, "Okay."
Nice.
So
just,
yeah, but okay. Let's go back to you. So you're like younger, you're performing, and your mom is like all about it. Were you actually thinking it was like something you can pursue, or did you kind of believe your dad, where it was like I had to find something in quotes real?
I honestly think my career has been fits and starts because there is all of that conditioning that this isn't really something that's legitimate. And I think I've had to work through a lot of that psychological, like I thought I was in my mind, I was like, oh yeah, I don't really believe them, whatever. I'm going to do whatever I want. But I think like the more I kind of delved into it, the more I was like, no, I'm totally conditioned to think that this is not legitimate.
That's exactly like, how I feel. Yeah.
And so it's like high years of therapy bills. Like what, can you just let me do what I wanted so I didn't have to spend the last 15 years in therapy trying to work out why I think that this is like not a legitimate life to have.
You know, that's all I can say to that. Don't I know that life? Yeah. It's true. I mean, I always think of that song, that show Crow Song. It always comes on my, I don't know why, but it always comes on my like Spotify playlist. What is it when she's like, if it makes you happy, that song?
Yeah.
Oh,
God, it always irritates me because I'm like, so fucking unrelatable.
So like, what a white mentality.
I'm not allowed to do what makes me happy. It's not how it works. And when I did do what made me happy, I had to go through hell to get it done and like listen to my parents bitch at me for years before they were like, oh, you have a salary? You have health insurance? Okay. And it's like, oh, fuck you. You were not supportive when I was fighting for my fucking life out here. And now they're like, our daughter is a big producer or whatever the fuck. And you're like, oh, fuck off. Like, yeah, don't try and use me as clout now after everything I went through. It's not what makes me happy, Cheryl. So anyway.
No, seriously. My parents were like, no, you're not doing this. You're not doing this. They even were like, we're going to pay for your college unless you study theater or like
that's exactly what they said to me. My situation and art. Yeah.
And so I now have a history and philosophy double major.
Okay. Yeah.
And then had to pay for going to theater and training after and going to comedy training after on my own dime. And I was like, you guys, I lost like 10 years because of this. Like, do you understand that you're like, but you know, it is what it is. We are where we are. It's like the next generation of young folks. I'm like, I hope that their parents aren't so crazy and that they get the opportunities that we, you know, that a lot of us didn't get or are still trying to get because we like lost all this time. So, you know, and it's also complicated by the fact that like being from cultures that have like all this trauma and like ongoing trauma and ongoing war and violence and identity issues and demonization, it's like, oh yeah, that's really fun when you're trying to like go out and have a comedy and acting career. Like, let's just, you know, it's like trying to navigate how that not only impacts your mental health, but like, where do you put that in terms of like, do you speak out about that? Do you just put it in the back? burner? Do you part of your identity? Is it like, you know, there's like so much with that that I'm like, yeah, let's just make it the most complicated, you know, complicated road to success that we can find. Like throw all the obstacles our way.
Right. But I do think it's like the perfect basis for like being funny.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like all this trauma, all this like aggression and intensity from your culture and like gender roles and how everything is forced on you in this way where you're like, dude, I'm just the California, you know, like you're just like, yeah, I'm Persian or whatever. Yeah, I'm Palestinian. But like you did raise me in California. So I'm like pretty chill. So this is like a lot and you're harshing my vibes like 24/7. And then I feel like the combo of all that, and of course, not everyone's raised in California, but I think just being raised in America, you kind of have this perspective of like, it doesn't need to be this intense. Yeah. But like that's your whole family's literal vibe because of what they've experienced and all their own, you know, trauma that has passed down through generations. And then it's like, this is pretty funny. You're like, I've found a way to contextualize all this in a pretty funny way. And it's made me, you know, take my trauma and turn it into something that like brings me joy.
Yeah.
But God forbid you ever try and explain that to your parents.
I think for most of us, it's also like comedy is just a way to cope. Like there's just, you're so depressed and so sad and confused and don't know anything about anything. Like you have to be, you have to turn to comedy. There's nothing else. Like for that, that's what it was for me. Like if I made someone laugh, I felt good for the rest of the week. Like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like I just, not all the time, but I think sometimes comedy comes from a pretty dark place, just like as a means of coping.
Oh, absolutely. And for me, it's like I started off just doing straight acting. And then it was like, oh, we don't know what to do with you. Maybe you could play a Mexican or, you know, like I was just like, oh, my God, what is happening? Like when I was auditioning 15 years ago before, like everybody wanted like you to play who you are. And there were actual roles for Arabs. It was like, everybody's like, we don't know what to do with you. You're so ethnically ambiguous that you can play anything. But then when we find out that you're not that thing, we kind of don't want to hire you. Mm-hmm. And then we're, you know, like, so it was just like, oh my God, can we just like, it's a muddy thing of like, do you only have to play yourself as an actor? Or like, can you play other things? Like, is that the point of an actor? So I was like navigating that world for a long while. And then at some point I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Like, I'm just going to write my own material because like it's just such a pain to find material that resonates with me that I want to do that I also can get cast in. And so I wrote my own one woman show with Kamau Bell in San Francisco before he was Kamau Bell. And he's a stand-up. He was like, your writing is like really dramatic, but really comedic. So let's just do this weird hybrid kind of thing where like you have these like act outs and then you have these stand up bits and then we like tell a dramatic story. And so through that process, I like found a place to put all that like trauma, hilarity, craziness all in like one place. And I was like, oh, it's like the juxtaposition of all that is really fun to play with and helped me find like my voice. Then I kind of navigated towards stand-up after touring my show for 6 years because I was like, oh, this is a place where, you know, you can like kind of really figure out exactly what your point of view is. Mm-hmm. And like as an actor, you don't really have that opportunity. You're in service of the script and the production and, you know, all of that other stuff. So it brought me to a place where I was like, oh, I can figure out what I really think about all of this and what I really want to say. And so that's kind of the focus. Although I do miss, and I am leaning back towards writing another one-person show because I miss, like, stand-up, it's like, you have to be funny, 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 hit, you're funny. Like, I feel like that is not as interesting to me as, like, let me tell you this totally tragic story and then let's laugh. Like, that, or let me make you laugh at this totally tragic story. Like, I'm really missing the element of like hybrid kind of performance. And so I'm looking at like working on material to see if I want to go back into touring shows once the world opens.
Can we talk about your show actually that you were touring with? Just because I think it's very interesting and I really like the title. Can you talk a little about that and give us a background on how you came up with it? And then, I mean, you kind of did a little, but like also get a little deeper and then talk about what you discussed in your show.
Okay, the show was called I Heart Hamas and Other Things I'm Afraid to Tell You. It was so fun to promote because I was like wearing this like camouflage and like sexy I Heart Hamas tank top, like which is like, you know, like the I Heart New York logo.
Yeah.
And it was like this weird 70s military chic porn. It was like, you know, like it was so fun to play with that image because all of the things that like as an Arab woman out in the world, you're not supposed to be with this little, like overtly sexual, super political, really cheeky about it, like really just tongue in cheek and like not giving a fuck. And also co-opting this idea that like talking about this has to be like daunting or it has to be like very done in like, this hush, very hush. Serious librarian kind of way. Like now we're talking about serious NPR issues.
It makes it less accessible.
Yeah, I needed it to reflect my personality. Like I actually moved to Palestine in 2000 and 2001 in time for the Intifada because I have impeccable timing, I like to say. And I agree with you, Anna. I'm using both names now. That like you growing up in America, you're like, dude, I'm American. You brought me here. Like you had me here. What's your deal? Like stop harshing my vibe all the time with your trauma. Like this is really a lot. But then I moved back to Palestine and I was like, oh, got it. Like my vibe is constantly being harshed here because people are shooting at me and like tear gassing me all the time. Not so fun. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that also like added a new dimension of like, not only did I like absorb the generational trauma, but I actually got to live the trauma for myself, like, which is a different animal than being raised outside of your culture or outside of your, you know, your place of birth. And so it was like, oh, diaspora living is a very different experience. Even if you still absorb the trauma and have the parents who are always talking about it and like watching the news constantly. And I don't know, were your parents like, you are not American? Like my parents were like,
yeah, they were pretty like, this is your culture. Don't stray. Right. That was why that's why they were so strict. They were afraid of us becoming too American and like that's losing what we had.
They'd be like, you're so Americanized. And it's like, I'm American. Right. I was born here. What you thought I would, you thought I would miss that? That's what happens.
Right. Yeah.
But I agree. When I went to Iran, I mean, I've been going to Iran my whole life, but like, as I got older and it was outside of like, just like hanging out with my cousins and running around and just like being dirty or whatever, like just running around in dirt and playing soccer. Like as I grew older and really started to like process what was around me, it was like I was absorbing all their trauma, seeing all the like drama within the family, like understanding why some people just didn't talk. Just it honestly, the more time I spent with my uncle who lost a son in an explosion, like my cousin, he like everything about him truly helped me understand everything about my family because he was like the patriarch of the family. Is my dad's oldest brother. They were just, after their parents died, like he kind of took over and taking care of everyone. And they lived in this town where he was like the guy who helped build the streets, you know? And so I was like interacting with him and watching how he was like helped, I don't know, just like understand everything of like why my dad is the way he is. He would also like, because my dad's not a very open guy with his feelings, but he would like tell me things of like why my dad did or said things. And I'd be like, thank you just for being a window into like my whole world and helping me understand everything. So in a way, like I became less harsh on my own parents because I was seeing them now in like a new light and I was like maturing and you know, I had gone to therapy. So I was able to like, I had tools to understand what I was absorbing versus just being like, you guys are such buzzkills, you know, which I was for like 90% of my upbringing of like, just leave me alone, you know?
Yeah, once you grow up old and you're old enough to realize like, oh, my parents are the way they are because of actual trauma that they've lived through. And I think especially as kids, they don't even want you to really know the extent of that trauma. I think I had that same experience, but I think it's good as adults to unpack that because not only do you learn about yourself, but you also just learn that it's one thing to be like in America, but like the fact that you actually went to Palestine and like understood like, oh, this is daily life for my people. And this is why my parents are so adamant about XYZ or whatever, I think that's a really amazing experience. It's just so hard to, for me, compartmentalize that kind of stuff. And like, oh yeah, the people that look like me are suffering, my family is suffering, and here I am back in America. Like, I feel maybe survivor's guilt, I guess.
Really feels like it contextualizes your family for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And like, there is a lot of PTSD, I think, as a result. You know, I lived through 2 years of occupation, which is like nothing in the life of a Palestinian. But for me, I was like, I am totally fucked up now. Mm-hmm. Like, this has been so traumatizing that I, you know, and I wasn't enduring the worst that Palestinians have experienced. Like, I still was living in a very like international city and had access to like a foreign passport and leaving and coming back and, you know, different. It was a different experience, but still like that day in, day out of constantly being like assaulted and occupied and mentally and emotionally like assaulted and occupied, as well as like some F-16 flying over your house and dropping a bomb on your neighbors and killing them. And you're like, oh, whoa, what just, like, what was that? Like, I'm just sitting on my balcony and now there's a huge explosion. Like, you know, the arbitrariness of it and the constant, like, we don't know what direction it's coming from keeps you so off balance that, like, my nervous system, you know, my friends there were like, I said, you know what? I feel like you're taking care of me because, like, I don't have the survival skills to deal with this. Like, it got to the point where I was like, I don't have the survival skills to, like, live through this. Yeah. It's like, not something that I've ever experienced.
I guess it's like a privilege check.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It helped me contextualize my family and my parents and, like, why what their craziness was about and, like, all the things that irritated me as a kid. I was like, oh, I can actually feel compassion about this because, like, I get where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Of course. I forgot who said this on the internet, but they were saying that children and people in Palestine, you can't classify them as having PTSD because their trauma is ongoing, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, like, that is just horrible. That's just inhuman. Like, constant trauma and suffering to the point where, like, there's no break. There's no breath of relief ever. You're just constantly living in a state of abuse and trauma and oppression. I don't think the majority of people in the U.S. especially, or anywhere that's not Palestine, can really understand. I mean, I can't definitely understand the extent of what they're going through. I'm just at a loss for words when I think of, like, Palestinians have lived through and what they continue to live through. And the fact that, like, in the 50s, when your family, like, left, it was still like that. Like, you know, it's like, imagine the people that didn't leave and, like, what they've still lived through the whole time. It's just a repetitive cycle of violence. And we all know about this if you listen to the podcast, I guess. But
I hope so. But, you know, this is why I came back and wrote that show. Because, it's coming from a very American perspective. Like, I grew up Palestinian. This is what I thought Palestinian was, going to these obnoxious conventions where everybody married their cousin. Mm-hmm. Like, I had all these weird rules. So it's like the show is about, like, what it was like growing up and what my conception of being Palestinian was. Like, the first half of the show is about that. And then the second half of the show is like, let's go to Palestine and find out what it's really like. And then it was like, fun, fuck, bombs dropping. Fun. Oh my God, bombs. You know, like, that's the thing. It also depends your location. Like, no one in Gaza is like fun. But in the West Bank, there are parts of the West Bank that are like, have more access, are more urbanized, are more international cities. And so it's like, you go to a party, you go to a nightclub, you're out at a restaurant hanging out. And then, like, all of a sudden there's the city's under curfew. There's a bomb dropping. Something happens. So it's like this bizarre kind of feeling of, like, somewhat normal, but constantly potentially terrifying. Mm-hmm. And it's like everybody's living on this weird, hyped up, anxious edge where it's almost like you get addicted to it. Like, all these journalists there were like, we love, like, this is, it's like so exciting. There's always like some, and you're like, that's kind of psychotic actually. But it's like this weird, like, edge of existence where you're like riding this, like, everything could be awesome or terrifying in 1 second, and we have no idea what's next. And so I came back and I, like, wrote this show and I started touring it, and it got this great reception, although it also got me a ton of, like, death threats and theaters, like, people called in bomb threats to theaters.
I mean, just the word Hamas, like, will give you a barrage of hate.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the reason I wanted to use it, because I was like, you're using this as a boogeyman. It's like this stand in for like Palestinians bad, Palestinians terrorists. We can shut down any argument with it. So I was like, I'm just going to use it so that I'm going to use it first. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use it in a way that questions. And part of why it's funny, because I only talk about Hamas for like 60 seconds in the show, honestly. And then people get really mad. They were like all the trolls, because trolls would come to my show and like want to protest. And they were like waiting for the moment they can protest. And then they were like, oh, it's all the way at the end and we have to sit through this entire show.
That's hilarious.
They would like get up and walk out, because really when I was talking about Hamas, it was like, what is resistance? What is armed resistance? Who has the right to resist? And who gets to decide who has what right to resist if you are not living that life? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I got it when I was there. Like, I don't have the right to justify people's forms of resistance or like critique people's forms of resistance if I am not living, like you said, a constant, like an ongoing barrage of constant trauma for my entire life. I don't get to then be like, you know, you should be nonviolently protesting. That's what we think you should do. It's like, F off. Like, spend a week in Gaza and then call me. So the point of, you know, I Heart Hamas was like, this is what you think about me. Like, you think that every Arab, Middle Eastern, or Palestinian, like, hates Jews, loves terrorism, and that the assumption that Hamas is just equated to terrorism versus a political party that got voted in power that was created by Israel. Like, it's a lot more complicated. And so I just, you know, used the show as a vehicle to like explore all those things and turn it on its head, but in like a really irreverent comedic way, which was awesome because people loved it. And that's why I kept touring the show for 6 years. But pissed off the haters so much. They were like, I bought a ticket and sat through this whole show and she never even talked about Hamas.
But the hilarious thing is like they bought a ticket. Like, you know what I mean? Like, right. they wanted to troll you so bad and were able to, but they still gave you money.
Yeah.
I know. It was awesome.
I think it's so funny. Let's take our last break. We'll be right back. Wrap up the show, asking more questions. So don't go anywhere. Okay, here we are again. I really regret not ever seeing I Love Hamas. It sounds perfect.
I Heart Hamas.
What did I say?
I Love. Oh, I mean, could be love too, but it's not.
I Heart Hamas. What am I saying? We're on I Heart Radio. Wow, I can't believe I fucked that up.
Exactly.
What are you going to do? So are you working, you were saying you're trying to get into more one woman shows type of stuff again?
Yeah, I've been doing stand-up on and off for the last whatever. I took a 2-year break because of pandemic and a head injury. So it was like I had a double break, which was awesome. I got 3 head injuries in 3 weeks in the end of 2018.
How'd that happen?
It was just dumb luck. Yeah. like a car accident, something falling on my head, it was just like craziness, like a metal door that like I pushed and like slammed back in my face. And I was like, oh, 3 head injuries in 3 weeks. Awesome. Every week I was like, are you kidding? Like, this just happened last week. Like, what's going on? Who has a hex on me?
Yeah, I think it is a hex an evil eye thing sometimes, because there was a week in college that I literally fell down 3 flights of stairs at different moments in time. And I was like, this is not normal. So I do think, and then I got 2 flat tires at the same time. I'm pretty superstitious, I guess, but I do think there was like an evil eye or something involved there.
Wow. Yeah. Nothing, literally nothing bad has ever happened to me.
Okay, good for you, Anna Anna. That's enough.
cartoonish things.
Pipe down over there.
Never once has anything ever happened to me.
Cartoonish things always happen to me. I literally broke my arm because I would just fell over. Like,
oh, wow.
Just, yeah. And that's another story. Okay. So are you working on anything right now?
I am. I'm working on some new material. I'm working on some online stuff. I'm hoping that this fall I can launch some things and that we'll see. I mean, we're also all kind of waiting and seeing what is going to happen with this world. Like, is live performance going to be a thing? Or are we going to go back into some quasi you know, pandemic lockdown. Right. Who knows?
I think both.
I think it's all, you think it's all going to like simultaneously.
I think some people are just going to like plow forward regardless because they just need that human connection again for like live events. And then other people are going to, you know, there's going to be attempts to shut us down and some people will listen and some people won't because, you know, America. Hashtag America.
Yeah. I think the Delta variant isn't being taken as seriously. And like, I still meet people like that are young like us and haven't been vaccinated. And it blows my mind. And I think you're right. But like once there's a group of people, like once they're out, they're out. Like they've already tasted freedom. There's no going back. You know what I mean? Even if there is a lockdown, they're not going to take it seriously, whatever. But yeah, I do think it's a little bit of both potentially. And it kind of makes me nervous because I don't think we should just go so hard so suddenly. Like you go to any event, any bar, any thing, and people are like sardines. And it's like, I don't trust that all these unmasked people are vaccinated. I don't trust that. I just don't trust anyone, I guess. Like I literally worked. Yeah. I wrapped a commercial. I'll make this short. I wrapped a commercial a couple weeks ago and I was working very intimately with the closest person I was working with that I was talking to unmasked at the office because everyone was vaccinated at the office, like staff-wise. He was like a 26-year-old guy. And at the very end, the last day, he was like, now that the job is over, I finally have time to get vaccinated. And I was like, what?
Wait, you can work on set and not be vaccinated right
now? I didn't know that. I assume, like, I genuinely was, my mouth was on the floor. I was so shocked. And I was like, and I asked the coordinator, like, did you know this? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, what do you mean, yeah? No one told me. I would have worn my mask the whole time. I would have maybe not even taken the job. It's like, it blew my mind. And apparently his excuse was like, I don't trust the government to put things in me. And like, literally, the three of us here, there's no one more, like, none of us trust the fucking government, you know? Like, I hate that excuse.
And
but
it's not even about the government. It's called science.
Yes!
I'll put anything in my body. I will put anything in my body. I don't give a shit anymore, okay?
Like, why do you, like, a vaccine, like, I'm sure he's done drugs. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, where's the line here? And so I already had trust issues. I already didn't trust people. But that experience, like, shook me. I was like, no. And he lives with his parents and, like, they're older. I can't wrap my head around that level of delusion, I guess. Like,
well, it's interesting because I'm going out of town tomorrow and I had a cat sitter and my cat sitter just texted me and was like, man, I think I got COVID at my 4th of July party and he has it. He definitely has COVID, but that's where he thinks he got it. He had an outdoor 4th of July party with like 40 people.
Mm.
And he's like, I have COVID. I can't come take care of your cat. Like it's really bad. And I'm vaccinated.
Yeah. I know multiple people that got it and that were vaccinated.
Yeah. But he's like, I'm going to the ER. Like, I can't breathe. Like, I feel terrible. Like, I think I'm, you know, and I'm like, wow, it's that serious and you're vaccinated? And he's like, yeah I got, like.
That's
got
to be the Delta, baby.
It is. They told him it's the Delta.
That is interesting because the two people I know that are vaccinated and got tested positive had very mild symptoms. So that does, maybe that's the difference. Like, maybe that's the Delta variant acting differently than the variant that we're vaccinated against or something.
Well, yeah, that's what they said. They said the Delta variant will still hit you hard. I mean, you just have less chance that you die because you're vaccinated, but doesn't mean that you're not going to, you know, get fucked up.
Yeah, he said he's like getting progressively worse as the days go on. Fuck. And I'm like, whoa, dude, that's actually scaring me because I already was being really cautious and really like, I don't know if I have friends who are just like back at it, like out five nights a week, inside, indoor eating, indoor bars. And I'm like, I'm cool on that. Like I'm the only person in Pilates class still masked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm like, listen, all you woo-woo white ladies, like I don't trust you. I don't know if you're all vaccinated. It's this honor system. Like when has the honor system ever worked?
Yeah, never.
I mean, literally, I went to a Whole Foods yesterday in Providence, Rhode Island, and I was the only person wearing a mask. And I was like, oh, okay, you fox. We get it. Wear your goddamn mask. I'm not going to catch a COVID Delta variant from you fucks in a Whole Foods, okay? Stop coughing on the fruit.
Yeah. It's funny because I actually kind of like the weird looks I get, like when I'm the only one that's masked. Like, it's funny because it's gotten flipped, right? Like, I used to give dirty looks to people that weren't masked. And now it's flipped and everyone hates me. And I'm just like, what does this have to do with you? They're just like, leave me be. I will never stop wearing a mask, honestly. Like, public transpo, whatever. Like, countries in Asia have been doing that for forever. If you feel sick, you cover your face for the courtesy of others. Also yourself. It's just, we don't have
I have to
here.
Say that while masking, my allergies were non-existent. I mm-hmm. never got sick, and I always get like one or two colds and flus every season. And it's like, same. Whoa, I am like chronically sick allergy lady who's like always has something. And I'm like, I spent a year not being sick and not having allergies. That's insane. And it was same. Awesome. But I remember that day, first day when I saw people, like it was like that random two people that you would see who were masking. And I was like, these people are really going overboard masking. Like, what's going on? And then within like a month, everybody yeah. was masking. But, yeah. and I bet you that guy's in his apartment like, you yes, motherfuckers, I told you. Like, everybody yeah. was looking at me like I was crazy.
Yeah.
But we've like flipped back to that mask person being the outlier and the crazy one.
And I'm fine. I'm fine being that person because I don't trust. I want my mask to be like a symbol that I don't trust you. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's all. You know what? I don't know. Like, and I don't.
All right. So we got to let Jennifer go because she's got to go live her life masked mm-hmm. up. So why don't you tell everyone where they can find you and follow you to keep up with your work?
Okay. I'm on the Twitter. I'm on the Instagram. I'm still even on the Facebook sometimes. You can find me at Jen Jajay. I'm Jen Jajay everywhere. It's easy. It's seamless. I still have the same 415 number I've had for 20 years.
Amazing. And that's G-G. Fucking, that's my Arabic side just kicked in. J-E-N-J-A-G. I did it again.
It's going to be spelled.
Do your parents have this
problem
too?
Isn't there going to be a bio down there?
I know. I just like, I was trying to help, but I made it worse. I seriously, like, that's the fob in me coming out a little bit.
That is the fob in you. Are you like going to call everything like pel pepper?
I still say things wrong because my mom taught me how to speak English kind of. So, and she's an immigrant. So that's, yeah.
Yeah, they're like overcompensating with too many P's because there was no P. Yeah. And I'm like, everything is not a P.
Everything is not a P. On that note, this is Ethnically Ambiguous, Ethnically Amb, A-M-B-B on Twitter at Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hostney on Twitter. Just tweeting away. Not really. I'm lazy.
So yeah, until next time. My mind is blank.
Stay jumping off cliffs. Okay, goodbye.
Okay, bye.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.